Blog Talk Radio.
Scott, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Poole, and my guest today is Scott Ritter. And Scott is going to talk about the issue with Russia and the Ukraine. So when I watch the news and read the paper, Scott, it looks pretty ominous. What's your idea about what's going on?
Well, I mean, what's going on now is Russia has prepared the legal foundation for a massive military incursion into Ukraine, the goal of which will be to terminate Ukraine in its current state. The Zelensky government will be eliminated. All nationalistic Ukrainian political movements will be eliminated, and a pro-Russian puppet government will be installed. Russia made it clear from the very start that it could not tolerate a Ukraine that was seeking to join NATO, that could possibly join NATO, that could become integrated in a NATO military alliance, whether as a member or by proxy, which is what we were seeing with, $1 billion worth of arms shipped to the Ukrainian military, NATO military trainers on the ground training the Ukrainian military, Ukraine dispatching military troops in support of NATO missions abroad, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. Russia just simply could not tolerate this. They said they couldn't. They gave the West every chance to change the narrative, to come up with a formulation that had Ukraine declaring neutrality through a treaty. And NATO and Ukraine opted out. And so now Ukraine will be destroyed. It will happen. There's nothing the West can do to stop it. There's nothing Ukraine can do to stop it. So that's what we see unfolding right now. It'll be a phased operation, I believe, with Russia initially moving to expand the territory held by the two newly declared independent republics of Luhansk and Donetsk to the territories that encompass the totality of those oblasts or regions. Right now, the separatist forces occupy about one third of each one of these oblasts. The other two thirds are occupied by Ukrainian forces. The Russians have made it clear that they're going to retake the totality of the territory of these two newly independent states. And in doing so, we'll probably engage the Ukrainian army in extremely serious military combat, which will expand and result in Russia occupying Kiev, replacing the Zelensky government with a puppet government, and then moving to secure the border of Ukraine and Poland so that the appropriate security operations can take place to cleanse Ukraine of all extreme right-wing nationalistic elements.
A couple of shows that we've done in the past, you didn't think that Putin would be doing what he's doing. What happened?
No, I never said Putin wouldn't be doing what he was doing. I said that Putin would be preparing better. People were saying he's going to invade tomorrow, and I said, no, he's not. because Russia is a very structured, legalistically structured state. And so, Putin can't just simply order Russian forces to invade. That's not how it works. He needs to get permission of the Ukrainian parliament. When everybody's saying that Russia's going to attack tomorrow, I was like, no, he hasn't gotten permission of the Ukrainian parliament yet. He hasn't done his, the due diligence, so to speak. And so we had to wait for that to happen. That has happened now. I had thought he was going to do a more formal presentation before the Russian National Assembly, but he shortcutted that by holding that press conference or that televised event the other day, where he gave an hour-long speech outlining the history of Ukraine from his perspective, and then taking the parliamentary movement, the motion to create these two independent states, and acting on that, and then sending that to the National Assembly, which voted in favor of it. So, he did everything I thought he would have to do before he could put troops in, and now it appears that he will go forward. He gave the West every chance to back out of this. I mean, that's what I want to say, too, is that he gave the West every chance, every opportunity to stop this from happening, and the West did not take advantage of that.
Now, he's been in power over 20 years, and in that 20-year period, did you see this coming?
Well, no, because in that 20 years, understand that what we're seeing here isn't 20 years of a Putin dictatorship. What we're seeing here is 20 years of anti-Russian posturing by the West. When Putin came in 1999, NATO had done its first expansion, allowing Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic in. This was in violation of a promise given by NATO to Gorbachev back in 1990, when Germany was reunified, that NATO would not expand one inch eastward. And Putin in 2000 raised this issue with Clinton, saying, look, expansion threatens us. You said you weren't going to do it, and now you're doing it. And one of the reasons why it threatened Russia is that this ostensibly defensive alliance in 1999 bombed Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. So a defensive alliance carried out an illegal act of aggression in accordance with international law, a military offensive that had no authority under the United Nations Security Council, totally a unilateral move by NATO. They bombed Belgrade, a Russian ally, and Putin saying, hey, we got a little bit of a problem here. You're not a defensive alliance. You bomb people, and you're expanding. Now, we could understand NATO expansion if you let us in, because then as a member of NATO, we would no longer be threatened by NATO expansion because we're part of the group. It's a consensus organization. You can't do anything without everybody agreeing to it, so we're no longer threatened. He mentioned this in his speech the other day. And what did Clinton do? Clinton ignored him, had the CIA send assistance to the Chechen rebels who were then engaged in the second Chechen war against Russia, and further expansion of NATO all the way up to the Russian border. And when finally in 2008, remember, Putin, Putin evolved. In 2007, he gave a speech that should go down in history as one of the greatest speeches of this century so far, closely followed by the speech he gave the other day, by the way, but in which he, to the Munich Security Conference, in which he told the West, what you're doing is unacceptable. Russia can't accept this. But what did the West do? They held the Bucharest summit, NATO Bucharest summit in 2008, invited Ukraine and Georgia in, nations that are not only former Soviet republics, but abut Russia. They share a border with Russia, which means NATO now has expanded to the borders of Russia. And in 2009, William Burns, the ambassador to Moscow, the U.S. ambassador, currently he's the director of the CIA, but then he was the U.S. ambassador. He wrote a memo, "Niet means niet," meaning no means no, explaining the Russian position. And he said, look, the Russians have been very articulate that they feel threatened by this. And then he said, they have a point. We need to respect this. We need to do something that prevents Russia from reacting to this, because if they react, we're going to have a conflict. Putin had been speaking till he was blue in the face, saying no to this. You can't do this. This threatens us. This is a problem. And what did the West do? Nothing. Worse than nothing. They continued to pour weapons into both Georgia and NATO. And so what we're seeing here today isn't the byproduct of 20 years of Putin being a bully. It's 20 years of the West ignoring Russia when it says we have a legitimate national security concern about the expansion of NATO, and that if NATO expands to our borders, we view that as an existential threat worthy of military conflict. So all Russia has done is react as any nation would do under similar circumstances. Any nation would respond this way, including the United States.
You know, I recently read a book about an indigenous history of the United States, and Manifest Destiny, from the East Coast to the West Coast, you know, we bullied our way and subjected indigenous people to all kinds of horrors and tortures and starvation and everything. So would you say this is kind of like the same concept that we're doing?
No, I view this in two separate phases. Look, every country has gone through an expansion period. I'm not justifying it. It's horrible. It's bad for the weak. The American Indians, the Native Americans, did their own expansion. Why do you think the Lakota were living in North Dakota, South Dakota, and the Plain States? Because they were kicked out of Michigan by the Ojibwa.
Right.
So there was this kind of, you know, territorial expansion fighting going on everywhere, where the powerful defeat the weak, and until you build something, it doesn't make it right. That's just history. Russia did it. If you take a look at the growth of Russia, you know, heading eastwards, the subjugation of the various, Central Asian peoples, the development of the Cossack system to populate the frontier, to spread Slavic Russia into areas where no Slavs have ever lived before. Germany did the same thing. France did the same thing. Italy did the same thing. England did the same thing. It's how great nations become great. It doesn't make it right. It just is what it is. But that's the formation of nation states. Now, once nation states are formed, you know, how they interact with the rest of the world is a different dynamic. We had colonialism. We had imperialism. But in the post-World War II era, that was all supposed to be over. You know, that's why we created the United Nations. That's why we have the United Nations Charter, et cetera. What NATO is an abomination to the United Nations Charter. There is no legitimacy under the United Nations system for a military alliance like NATO. And NATO operates outside the framework of law. We saw that both in Kosovo, where they did not have permission of the Security Council to bomb. We saw that in Libya, where they carried out regime change totally independent of a Security Council authorization. We see the United States invading Iraq in 2003 in violation of international law, and NATO supporting that. So what we're seeing here is not manifest destiny. What we're seeing here is basically an American superpower hegemony being imposed on the world using what the United States calls a rules-based international order that solely benefits the United States. But it's about nation states in the post-imperial, post-colonial world. It's a new kind of irresponsible behavior, shall we say, by nation states, one that focuses on a unipolar world. And it's being pushed back by Russia and China, India, Brazil, and others who say, no, this is a multipolar world. The world is about so much more than just the United States. And that's what we're seeing playing out, because NATO, the development of Europe in post-World War II, has been such that Europe has been retarded in terms of traditional, nation structures, weak militaries, weak economies, weak political systems. They had to be propped up by NATO. so that they could grow, and they got artificially overconfident. And today, Europe cannot exist without NATO because they have no alternative to NATO. They're addicted to American power. They can't exist separate from American power, and the United States is taking advantage of that, and pushing NATO towards a conflict with Russia that doesn't need to exist. Russia is not a threat to Europe. Russia simply wants to live in peace and is disturbed by a military alliance whose sole focus today is to confront Russia. Therefore, they're concerned when that alliance actually saddles up to the Russian border.
What do you think the ultimate outcome of this will be? It looks pretty frightening.
You know, one of the great stories of the last century, which is undertold, was how the United States managed the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, which was the military alliance that was aligned with the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union, without Europe, falling down the rabbit hole of war. There was some violence in Romania where Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife were killed. But by and large, it was the peaceful dissolution of, major geopolitical forces. And George W. Bush, or George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, I'm sorry, should get great credit for this. It's one of the great diplomatic achievements of modern times. It could have been much worse. We're talking about the dissolution of the Soviet Union with thousands of nuclear weapons that could have gone astray, or there could have been, fighting between these republics using nuclear weapons, that Russia could have tried to hold on to the Warsaw Pact, kicking and screaming, requiring military force to liberate the regions that could have led to a nuclear conflict. It didn't happen because we had wise men who were willing to be patient. What we're looking at today is a situation that can only ultimately end with either destruction of Russia as it currently exists politically. That means that Vladimir Putin and the system that he's put in place for the last 20 years is eliminated, or the destruction of NATO. The two cannot peacefully coexist. That's where we're at today. The era of peaceful coexistence is over. We're now into existential conflict. How this is going to end, Russia isn't going to lose this. I'll just say that right up front. They're not going to lose. NATO is going to lose. The question is, how will NATO be defeated? If it can be managed properly so that it is a peaceful dissolution of a military alliance that has no viability today, no reason to exist, and still maintain the European infrastructure, the European state system that isn't threatened with collapse, isn't threatened by a Russia overplaying, the world can survive this. But if NATO decides to go down kicking and screaming, and this devolves into actual conflict between Russia and NATO, the chances of that going nuclear are very high, and the chances of containing that nuclear conflict to Europe are very low, meaning it will become a global conflagration. So this is how it's going to end. Unfortunately, most Americans don't understand it. The decisions we have made about Ukraine are dictating the future courses of action. They're tying our hands. And unless we get an American president who is willing to say, well, we're wrong on this, I'm surrendering, I'm out of NATO, we're not going to be part of this, we're going to be going to war in Europe. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, maybe not next year. But at some point in time, we're going to be compelled to go to war with Europe because we've tied our own hands. We've aligned ourselves with a military alliance that has no legitimate reason to exist except to confront Russia. And Russia has said, we're not going to take it anymore.
During the presidential election of 2020, did any of the candidates see this coming? And was it addressed at all?
No, I mean, the time and place for this to be discussed was the 2016 election where Donald Trump did say, rightfully so, what is NATO? Why are we in NATO? What do we get out of NATO? And he also said, why can't we be friends with Russia? Now, people took this to, you know, his political opponents then jumped on this and said, oh, you're kissing up to that dictator Putin. It's a brutal dictatorship. NATO is a historic alliance that we have to be part of. That was the time and place for that discussion. But the good, valid points that Trump was making got overshadowed by the story of, allegations of collusion that were promulgated by his Democratic opposition tear down his chances for being elected. But, you know, he won the election, but he brought with him the baggage of being seen as, you know, this stooge of Putin. So he was never able to effectively act on his impulses. It was a battle for the entire 4 years that only hardened the stance of the day. Remember Joe Biden standing up and after the election and giving that speech. I'm the only man that can go toe-to-toe with Vladimir Putin, he said. Really, Joe? You're going to go toe-to-toe with Vladimir Putin? I mean, what stupidity? What president says this? What president compounds that by saying, I looked into his eyes and I saw the soul of a killer? What president says this? I mean, this is just lunacy. It's stupidity. 2020, we didn't talk about this because, you know, Trump was playing the fake election game. Biden was busy, piling on the, Trump is a Russian stooge. So we didn't have any serious discussions about foreign policy. 2016 was the time for that. We did have some interesting entrees into the topic, especially about the viability of NATO. Why should we be members of NATO? That didn't get fully developed because the American public became paralyzed by this distraction of allegations, which had been proven to be unfounded, about collusion between the Trump, candidacy and the Russian government.
What was Hillary Clinton's stance on NATO?
Well, Hillary is the traditional establishment stance, which is NATO is an integral part of American national security. We have to be there for our NATO allies, that the world is stronger with NATO. And remember, at the time that this debate was taking place in 2016, NATO wasn't just about the defense of Europe. NATO was in Afghanistan. NATO was in Iraq with a giant training mission. NATO had opened up a front in North Africa, expanding NATO's sphere of influence. Amazing how we hear that word. Sphere of influence into North Africa. NATO had opened up an office in the Middle East because they now had a sphere of influence in the Persian Gulf. And NATO was talking about opening up offices in the Pacific because now the Pacific became a sphere of influence for NATO. This is this is what Hillary Clinton was buying into. This was the expansive role of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization into a global military power. That's where she stood on this issue. And she was vehemently anti-Russian. Remember, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State in 2011, has been accused by the Russians of fomenting domestic disturbances in an effort to disrupt the Russian presidential election. The irony that she actually did disrupt the Russian presidential election in order to keep Putin out of power, as opposed to, again, the unproven allegations of Russian action in 2016. But, Hillary is anti-Russian, anti-Putin, and pro-NATO.
So there's talk that Hillary might run again for president. Do you consider that a pretty ominous sign as far as what's going to happen in the future?
Look, I consider the 2024 election to be an ominous election, period. The Republicans have yet to articulate somebody other than Donald Trump. And regardless of where I stood with Donald Trump in 2016, which was basically condemning him as a human, he's a despicable personal character, condemning much of his domestic policies, the stance he took about the Hispanic judge, things he said about John McCain, who I don't like. I didn't like. I was never a supporter of McCain, but my God, the man was a prisoner of war, and he was challenging McCain's service. I mean, so, you know, Trump was just a horrible, horrible person, but he had some ideas about how America interacted with the world that were different than the establishment view that had only gotten us into trouble. It was the establishment that got us into Iraq. You know, it was the establishment that got us, tied down in the Middle East for a 20-year conflict. And Trump was saying, no, we can do better than this. So I liked him then, but after 4 years, he pretty much disqualified himself from being a viable candidate because of his stance on the election. It doesn't matter what you think about how the vote should have gone. In the United States of America, we have an election, there's a declared winner, and we have the peaceful transfer of power. And if you're not going to play that game, and sometimes it is a game, we saw that in Bush v. Gore. We saw that with Kennedy back when he was running against Nixon. So, you know, we know that elections aren't perfect. We know elections have been corrupted. We know that sometimes the person that sits in the White House maybe wasn't the person that actually won the election. But what makes America function as a democracy is the peaceful transfer of power, and Trump blew that out. So he should be terminated as a potential candidate, but he's there, hovering. And then what? The Democrats have Biden or Kamala Harris, who are just, I mean, Biden is a disgrace. And then what are they going to put Hillary Clinton in his place? Man, we are a nation of 320 million people. Can we not find some qualified persons to represent us in the highest positions of power? Why do we have to pick perpetual losers? Because that's what we have. Trump is a loser. Hillary is a loser. Biden is a loser. Let's come up with a winner. But we don't seem to be able to do that because we're a fractured nation where candidates of real potential will either be destroyed by the process of nomination or just opt out and say, I don't want to be a part of this because I have a family, I have a life, I don't need this. So we end up getting the narcissists who thrive in this environment. And so I'm concerned that whomever we get in 2024, it doesn't matter whether it be a Democrat or a Republican, is going to be picked from a certain class of people that thrives in the toxic political environment that exists in America today, and they're not going to be qualified to deal with the very difficult foreign policy and national security problems because they're going to have been selected because of their ability to survive domestic partisan combat here at home.
Scott, our time is up. I always enjoy talking with you, and I'm sure this is going to be an ongoing story for a while. So you've been listening to Scott Ritter. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. If you like this show, follow us on Facebook. Thanks, Scott. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me.